You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we aired part one of our conversation with Magna Frosted, professor of law at the Faculty of Law at UIT, the Arctic University of Norway. Alongside Elisa, Professor Frosted explored the impact of past and recent Houthi attacks on the global economy and what enforcement mechanisms are available to address such attacks on merchant vessels. This week, we bring you part two of that discussion. Elisa and Professor Frosted conclude their conversation on the regulation of flagged vessels and dive into the Arctic to examine the future of global shipping and maritime regulation in the Northern Seas. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
Let's move on. What about the International Criminal Court? What, if anything, can they do here?
The ICC. Now, one of the things to note here is that, if I'm not mistaken, the Yemen as such is not a party to the ICC. However, many of the flag states are, and things taking place on your vessel will be of relevance in the way that it might be seen as taking place on your territory. So basically, the ICC looks at things as a second tier, really, because states should be doing this themselves. But then if the states don't want to do it, then if it's a citizen of one of the member states, or if things take place on the territory of a member state, then that starts getting interesting for the ICC. Though the prosecutor decided against trying Israelis in relation to this Mavi Marmara vessel that the Israelis stopped from coming to Gaza. They're the flag state.
Magna, before we go on, can you say what that vessel, the one that the Israelis stopped, what was the name of that vessel again? What was its purpose?
Oh, Mavi Marmara was a passenger vessel, part of a fleet that was kind of meant to provide a much needed equipment and what have you to Gaza. And the Israelis, a few years back, had blockaded the coast of Gaza. And having tried to have this convoy go to an alternate port, convoy did not want to do so, the Israelis stopped them. And you had some of these convoy members killed during the Israelis getting control of this vessel, Mavi Marmara, because it was, the passengers were not all of them, say, peaceful protesters. So things escalated a bit. Now, so the flag state wanted to have this prosecuted because it took place on its territory. However, the ICC there, the prosecutor, decided not, because it was felt that this was not sufficiently kind of serious case for it to be involved in. Now, I reckon this consideration will play out here as well, because yes, violent acts take place against these vessels flagged with member states of the ICC, and it could be linked potentially to war crimes in a non-international armed conflict, so destruction of property, really. But I don't think the prosecution will prioritize such cases, because they have their hands full with other nasty situations as things now stand. But the flag state, of course.
And who was the flag state again? I forget.
The flag state here was the Comoros, if I'm not much mistaken. So they kind of led this endeavor, but Greece and Cambodia played a role, it seems, as well.
Let's talk for a second about the flags. We sort of touched on this. How does the flag flown by any vessel matter in terms of which law might apply, one? And then two, I guess the question becomes, if it's considered that country's territory, let's discuss for a second how that might be perceived, because it's their territory. Obviously, an attack on a vessel deemed territory, could that be deemed, you know, an attack on the territory of that country?
The flag state, when things take place on its vessel, it will have kind of territory jurisdiction. So if it manages to get their hands on the culprits, then they would have jurisdiction to prosecute them for these acts. And I reckon it boils down to the getting your hands on the culprits, basically, as regards prosecution. Now, the other issue is, can a state respond in a different role in a way than as a police officer, quasi, respond more in the soldier way, as in the attack upon the vessel being considered attack upon a military and armed attack on the flag state, as understood under a UN Charter Article 51. Here we need to differentiate between naval vessels and merchant vessels. There is general agreement, and it has been all extended purposes pointed at by the ICJ and the OAS platform case, that an attack upon a naval vessel will qualify as an attack upon the flag state. The more problematic issue is whether an attack upon, say, a single merchant vessel represents an attack upon the flag state, because these vessels have very different, say, functions. One represents the flag state in a formal capacity as kind of like the sharp end of the sword, whereas the other is privately owned and do not kind of to that extent generate state responsibility for what it does as do naval vessels. And we don't find the definition of this or the answer to this by looking at the wording of Article 51 of the UN Charter. So you kind of need to go elsewhere in order to kind of clarify this, try to find the, say, state practice that brings some sort of clarity to the issue. One place you tend to go is to look at a resolution of the UN General Assembly back in 1974, which is the definition of aggression. Now, this is a different term than armed attack. It's a definition of a term found in Article 39 of the UN Charter, not in 51, where you find armed attack. But the ICJ has kind of used this resolution to kind of bring clarity as to what is Article 51 armed attack meant to be as well. And there is a different reference there to then something being a prima facie act of aggression. One of the examples is an attack by the armed forces of a state on the land, sea, and air forces. Now, there you find your, among other things, your naval vessel, or marine and air fleets of another state. So the issue has to some extent been, well, how is this marine fleet to be understood? Now, the same wording actually from this resolution is found in the ICC statutes in relation to crime of aggression. And well, a fleet, that presumably means more than one vessel. If you go to the negotiation that led to this resolution by the General Assembly, you see that there were point thinking at, say, if you kind of attack the majority of a fishing fleet when the fishing fleet had vital economic interest to you. So they were thinking about kind of large scale activities that had a tremendous impact on the flag state.
Sure. The ICJ, we're seeing some of this right now, right? With the Philippines and the fishing vessels and the engagement by China. It was a bit prescient.
And the issue was raised by the US before the ICJ in the oil platform case, where Iran brought the US to the ICJ.
Can you just quickly give us a little bit more on that? A lot of our listeners are young, may not realize. What was the oil platform case? What was that factually? Yeah. What was that about?
Was a number of oil installations that were attacked as a consequence of vessels similar, linked at the very least to the US, having been attacked previously. And so this was during the tanker war setting of the 1980s. So basically, the Iranis wanted to have the court say that the U.S. did not abide by its obligation under a bilateral treaty of friendship and commerce, which kind of mirrored some of these underlying rules. And here, this is where the court kind of, in a way, said that, well, if there is an attack upon a naval vessel, then this is largely to be perceived as an attack upon its flag state. But it didn't answer the question as regards whether an attack upon a U.S. flagged merchant vessel constitutes an attack upon the U.S. Basically because it said, well, this weapon here that was sent off far away from the area of impact couldn't have been specifically intended to hit that specific vessel. So therefore, you kind of lacked the intention of hitting it. And therefore, you cannot talk about an armed attack in this setting. So it kind of jumped over the fence where it was at its lowest, in a way, not deciding anything it didn't have to decide. So yeah, in literature, views differ. Some say, well, yeah, you can attack if it's one of your merchant vessels are hit. Some kind of go for the plural that some vessels, but it's kind of unclear how many. Whereas other kind of link back to, say, the negotiation previous to the definition of aggression resolution, saying, well, they are actually talking about much more than a few vessels, which means that you cannot really have an armed attack against the flag state if only a few of its merchant vessels have been attacked. And that's my view as well.
Yeah, but it raises the specter about what if there's a consistent attack on vessels carrying a particular commodity that would ultimately have an impact on a nation. You know, if it's oil carrying vessels or vessels that might be carrying COVID vaccines or something that could become essential to the health of a particular nation, one has to wonder if something like that could again sort of refine this understanding of the law in this context.
To some extent, what you're pointing at is something that has been an issue in relation to, say, cyber similar attacks, where one has, in a way, kind of looked at the consequences of the state following such an act. In these settings, to a large extent, the consequences are perceived to have taken place on its kind of homeland territory.
Yeah, the impact being felt there, right.
So far, we haven't gotten to where you kind of cover the indirect consequence of one of your vessels out at sea sinks and has an important commodity that kind of brings consequences then on your home turf, so to say. But it has in literature, late Joachim Dienstein, he pointed out that, well, but if you have a passenger vessel and that sinks, could one perceive an exception in a way there, because, well, you have, this is probably what is meant, because, well, you have lots of citizens that are then killed.
A cruise vessel, you know, loaded with passengers in Miami or, yeah.
Indeed. And you can pour quite a few thousands on board those. Could that then potentially be considered as an attack upon, say, the home state of the citizens? And it kind of links up with the more general discussion on whether attacks upon citizens abroad can be equated with an attack upon their home state. And views here are very divergent. Part of the criticisms that this is going to be used, or rather abused, by some military powers to get on land to kind of safeguard their...
To justify an incursion.
Yeah. And they stay longer than is needed for the evacuation. And then things get nasty. So there is a kind of disquietness as regards expanding this. But yes, it's not really settled.
I think this is such an important area of the law. I also think in the United States, and of course felt around the world, is the fact that the United States has grown significantly dependent on goods from China. And China is considered, you know, a hostile country in terms of the United States relationship with them. This brings me to the future. I like to look way out into the future. And as I look way out into the future, I see the law of the sea becoming increasingly important. How trade is regulated, and nothing makes it more important than the fact that the polar caps are in a state of melting. And we know that China and Russia are thinking of the current polar ice caps as being potential global shipping routes. China actually has ice cutters up there. You know, Russia has infrastructure up there. You know that more than anyone, being in the north of Norway, where you could almost throw a rock at Russia. Russia and the United States, I think even the Norwegians, have planted flags on the polar caps. And beneath those flags are believed to be the world's largest supply of oil, well exceeding anything in Saudi Arabia. So you teach and you deal with young people from all over the world. I mean, do you disagree? This is sort of what is where we're going.
Well, at the very least, global warming is a reality. We kind of ignore that. What has led to it is another issue. And we see permafrost. I think it's kind of storing roughly 50% of the carbon capture. Permafrost leaves, we have consequences. So environmental law will be a growing area of expertise needed. And as you pointed out, with global warming, we have a reduction of the ice coverage in the Arctic Sea. There is stipulations that perhaps by 2050, we will have a near ice-free Arctic Sea during summertime, because it will freeze over during winter when there is no kind of sunlight, etc. And this means that it will eventually become easier and easier to travel through. To begin with, say, icebreakers, but you can later on rely less on those. And it will shorten the trip from Asia to Europe. So there is going to be more traffic up there. And it will be interesting to see whether this also brings with it a more, say, environmental incidents, because the ecosystem is quite fragile up there. You mentioned this with the resources, and there is quite a lot of, say, high seas up there, the Arctic Ocean then being a sea. So you will have then area where you will cannot rely upon, say, the coastal state to regulate things strongly. You have to have some sort of additional international regime for it. But when it comes to the seabed, there is only going to be a small part that is not claimed by the coastal states. They might probably be inclined to get their hands on those resources in due time. And that kind of extraction of resources, of course, with an environment that is fragile, raises issues as well.
I guess the question is the law of the sea. What is it? Is there anything in the law of the sea that anticipates the fact that the sea is expanding? And thus the application of the law is potentially expanding into places where we've never thought of it as having any application.
Well, that's in a way the good thing with the North Pole compared to the South Pole, because it's salt water. So there, by definition, you have the UNCLOS applicable. And you have Article 234 ice-covered areas that kind of gives the coastal state some additional powers as regards navigation, even this exclusive economic zone, to the extent that there is a, quote, ice covering such areas for most of the year. And that is the way things are today. But with less ice, then that provision, that special provision, will then cease to factually apply. And then you will kind of fall back upon the default rules on what rights do states have on the high seas? What rights do they have on the continental shelves in their exclusive economic zones? So you will kind of use the general regulation in areas of the map where you were somewhat disinclined to do much while the climate was the way it was. Those general rules will then have to take into consideration the additional environmental problems of undertaking activities in ecosystems that are quite fragile. Of course, the ecosystems will as well change if the weather climate changes, but nevertheless, we're in for a rather rough ride, I'm afraid, next couple of decades. Although I don't perceive there to be perhaps much political fighting between the coastal states there. I think they are quite interested in having their general rights apply here and in a way agreeing on where the borders will be between the different continental shelves. So far, there is a disagreement between some of them as regards the North Pole, for instance. But I think the coastal states will be more interested in getting an agreement so they can start kind of enjoying the benefits of being a coastal state than perhaps in making a political demonstration as to who owns the North Pole, for instance, or at least the seabed underneath.
Yeah, and it's interesting that many of those nations are accustomed to dealing with one another, but we are in a time of a Putin regime, and his cooperation has been uneven, I think is the best way to say that. We should just add, obviously, as of this recording, a number of the nations up there have joined NATO. And instead of Norway being the outlier, as it once was, up in Scandinavia, it's now more or less the Finns have joined and the Swedes have joined, and they're all up there in the north and in that area. And although they do make fun of one another, right? I mean, you know, Norwegians call the Swedes dumb, and I think vice versa. And the Finns complain about everyone else. And the Norwegians, I don't know how you're all still alive eating lutefisk, but you managed to be. So hopefully these things can be worked out in the near future, and there could be a civility and some international cooperation that sort of protects humanity and its access to these important resources that are, of course, for the benefit of all mankind.
There needs to be will to see us through these troubled times. That will often lies in the self-interests of states, and the real challenge is somewhat to align them, to be able to show that, well, this actually works fine for you as well.
So hopefully those conversations are starting now, because we don't want to wait for the crisis to ensue, because that makes it much harder to bargain. What advice would you give to young lawyers that might have an interest in developing their understanding in this area, perhaps exploring a career as regards the international laws pertaining to the law of the sea?
There are a number of programs, say master programs, where you can kind of focus on, say, maritime law and more, say, public issues like law of the sea. What are the entitlements of the coastal state, how far out, and flag states, and what have you. So there is the possibility to continue your studies. We have a Law of the Sea Master here at Tromsø, which has a nice diversity of student backgrounds. There is the possibility to then go and get additional knowledge. Then there is, as I mentioned, also the issue of, or at least environmental law, international environmental law, needs to be focused on even more than it has so far. If you have an interest in an area, then look it up, find a book, have a look-see. There is lots of talks of different kinds on the net, and see if this is your cup of tea. If it so is, then either dig into it on your own or try to get a structured, say, introduction to it via a program of some sort.
All right. Well, that's lovely advice. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. My guest has been Magne Frosted, a professor of law at the Faculty of Law at UiT, the Arctic University of Norway in Tromsø. We will write that in the notes to the cast, because there are letters in there that are Scandinavian letters. So you can know exactly where you can find him and his work, or even explore the master's program that he's referring to. He is the author of a recent article in the Articles of War publication out of West Point's Lieber Institute. We will hyperlink to those articles that Magne has authored and his book in the notes to our cast. So thank you for listening to NSLT, and be sure to share this episode with a friend and to discuss any of the topics we've covered in a thoughtful way. Remember to hear other people's opinions and their arguments. It's going to improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is more diverse, not just ethnically, but also in terms of the thoughts expressed, than any other country in the world. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the amazing and ever lovely Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.